This is Herbig, Marla, and Jeff and Kim Sayward on 27 April 1987, Labyrinths Through the Ages.
And I was going to meet the Sanders there, and I got there, and the janitors were busy mopping the floors in the cathedral. So they had all the chairs out. And I thought, I think that's a labyrinth. I wonder what that's for. I had no idea that I was having a fairly unusual experience to get to just see it out there with all the chairs gone. So I walked it because it seemed like the thing to do. And that was my last experience with labyrinths until a couple of years ago. My mother died, and my sister and I decided that we would take a trip and that we wanted to do something interesting. But we thought it would be great to have a chance to talk about something other than what did mother eat, what did the doctor say, how is she doing. We were just going to go do something, as she put it, really different. So we started exploring some things, and we said, well, we're part Scottish. Maybe we could go to Scotland and check out our ancestry. And so in our wanderings on the internet, we found these people, the Sawards. And here was a trip that was a tour of sacred sites in Scotland, which interests us greatly. So then we Googled Jeff Saward, and here was this book on labyrinths. I thought, well, that's curious. So off we went to Scotland, meeting the Sawards in a hotel, and had an absolutely fabulous time. And that was the beginning of an interest in maybe we could do some little exploring together about something that interests us both. They are the knowledgeable ones. I'm the one who's interested in labyrinths. Jeff is the editor of a journal that I can't pronounce. And there are some copies of it out at the table. You're welcome to... we were asked if we could get the book. The book isn't currently available in the States. So I'm just tormenting you with the cover of it. But I have to... it's my sister's, and I have to take it back to the Tri-Cities and give it back to her. And Jeff has in my research getting ready to go on this trip to Scotland, I discovered that Jeff is really regarded as one of the world's experts on labyrinths. And then, on the trip... This is six people in a van for 2 weeks, so I got to know the Sawards quite well. And I discovered that Kimberly wrote her doctoral dissertation. She has a PhD in psychology from the University of California at Santa Clara, Institute of Imaginal Studies. And her dissertation is on the labyrinth and the experience that people have. So, of course, we had some interesting conversations. And then, of course, being a Jungian, I got interested in, well, what did Jung have to say about labyrinths? And he had very little to say, in truth. But then I came across in, this is actually a nice little book called Psychology in the East, and it's Jung's foreword to several books that people asked that he wrote a foreword to the Tibetan Book of Great Liberation. He wrote a foreword to a book that's an introduction to Zen Buddhism. And he wrote a foreword to the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And in 1929, Richard Wilhelm asked him to look at a book that he was writing called The Secret of the Golden Flower. Secret of the Golden Flower. And it was the first time, Jung says in here, it was the first time that he was introduced to the thinking of the East. And it really changed something for him, because he had been looking at psychological development, psychological processing as a linear process. And here he started reading about the circular process. And I think it's where he doesn't use the word circumambulation in the introduction, but it's where he began to toy with that notion that we need to circumambulate our complexes rather than attack them head on. So he said something which I'll go into more tomorrow, but I think this is my understanding and my experience of the labyrinth. He says, the art of letting things happen, action through non-action, letting go of oneself, as taught by Meister Eckhart, became for me the key that opens the door to the way. We must be able to let things happen in the psyche. And that's not a very Western perspective, is it? The Western perspective is, you can have 10 visits or 12 visits, and you've got to do this, and let's see your objectives, and, you know, how have you developed? And Jung says, For us, this is an art of which most people know nothing. Now, he wrote this in 1938. Consciousness is forever interfering, helping, correcting, and negating, never leading the psychic processes to grow in peace. And then he says, to begin with, the task consists solely in observing objectively how a fragment of fantasy develops. Nothing could be simpler, yet right here the difficulties begin, because we consciousness starts yapping at them. And that's the process of walking the labyrinth, is a process of letting go. It can be a process of letting go and entering into something and being curious about what one will experience. Because my experience is that I never got what I thought I would get any time I was ever walked a labyrinth. Whether I've walked both of them at Grace Cathedral in the Bay Area several times, and certainly the outdoor labyrinth at the Ghost Ranch. And each time has been a very different experience. And it's a really powerful symbol of transformation, because transformation is not about you started here and suddenly you're here, or even with a lot of hard work you're here and you're very different than you were. Okay? My take on personal transformation really is best summed up by the dervish sheikhs. When the dervishes begin their ceremony, which is about personal transformation, the sheikh prays at the very beginning. When the dervishes come out, they have on a hat that symbolizes their tombstone and a cloak that symbolizes their coffin. And they take off that black cloak, and they're standing there in that white. And the sheikh, before they begin to work for the transformation of everyone, the sheikh prays, turn in the circle of your true existence. Be in harmony with your capacity, with your creative nature. Be in active submission. Active submission. And I think Jung could have written that. It's about being fully who you are. If you are a feeling type, then don't try to be a thinking type. It's fine to develop your thinking, but it is never going to be your first function, despite what the school system would like. Okay? So, I wanted to read you just a little tiny bit from Jung. I'm always amused when I call this out. It looks like the Bible, and it kind of is to some unions. This is his Memories, Dreams, Reflections, which is Jung's autobiography. And at the very, this is very, very near the end of his life. This is a man who at this point is in his early 80s. He's been very successful. He's been very maligned. He's had a wide variety of experiences. And he says, I am astonished, disappointed, pleased with myself. I am distressed, depressed, rapturous. I am all these things at once and cannot add up the sum. I am incapable of determining ultimate worth or worthlessness. I have no judgment about myself and my life. There is nothing I am quite sure about. I love that, because if you read the collective works, you quite think that. I have no definite convictions, not about anything, really. I know only that I was born and exist, and it seems to me that I have been carried along. I exist on the foundation of something I do not know. In spite of all uncertainties, I feel a solidity underlying all existence and a continuity in my mode of being. That's his transformation. That's not being different than who he is. It's being fully who he is in the fullness of being human. And as we talk on our wanderings around Scotland and tromping through fields, you ought to see the fields. Yes, 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 yes. We'd go to one, there'd be this stone circle over here, and we'd go over there, and oh, but there's this thing over here. You want to go through this cairn over here, and off we go. And we mused about how walking the labyrinth is a process like this, that actually you start out as you are and end up as you are, right? The difference between a labyrinth and a maze is that the maze is a trick. The maze can trap you. You will, once you enter a labyrinth, you will come out. You will go to the center and you will come out. That's the goal. It's the process. It's just like analysis. It's the process that counts. Okay? It isn't proving that you can do anything. It's submitting to the process where the actual growth occurs. We'll be talking about a lot of that more tomorrow. I'm really happy to introduce Jeff and Kimberly to you. They're going to show you some wonderful pictures and have a great conversation with them. Thank you.
Thanks, Marla. Do you want us to hold the microphone? Can you hear me now?
No.
Please. Does it help if we put it on the top of the laptop here?
How about that? Can you hear me now? Okay.
Right.
Go like this if suddenly you don't hear me. I don't have a very projecting voice. So I'm glad Marla talked a little bit about what it's like to travel with us, because we're going to take you on a tour tonight of some of the labyrinths that we've found all over the world. Jeff has been researching labyrinths a bit longer than I have, and together we, about 9 years ago now, We combined our lives. I moved from California, which is why I don't have an English accent, to England, where I'm completely outnumbered. And we've spent our lives researching labyrinths. We write about them, we photograph them, we teach about them, we give workshops. And it has been an incredible and a miraculous process, definitely a process of transformation. I don't recognize my life anymore, and I have no idea what it's going to look like tomorrow or in 10 years. So one of the things that we do is we go around and we see these labyrinths, and we have some great adventures. And I'm going to talk about those a little bit as Jeff goes through the pictures. Jeff is a historian. He can tell you the year that anything happened. I'm the people's person. I can tell you what day somebody was born, but I have no idea what year. So between us, you're going to get people's stories, and you're going to get the stories of the labyrinths, their whereabouts, how they came to be there, the distribution. So I'm going to turn the time over now to Jeff, and I'm just going to pop in and out with some of my stories about some of the labyrinths that I hope will help ground you in those labyrinths, give you a sense of what they're like, because they may look a lot alike, but there's just sometimes a different feel according to where it is found in the world. So Jeff's going to take you back to the beginning of time and some of the earliest labyrinths.
I don't know about the beginning of time, but certainly back to the beginning of labyrinths. Marla mentioned this difference between mazes and labyrinths, and I'll come to that at the correct point in the story. You need to understand that mazes, these things that you can walk into and get lost within, have actually only been around for around 500 years or so. They're a relatively recent invention. Labyrinths, on the other hand, which have one single pathway that leads from the entrance to the centre and then back out again, have been around for much longer. In fact, the earliest labyrinths that you can find are at least 4,000 years old. But the big problem with them is they're extremely difficult to date. So this set of examples I have up here on the screen, these rock carvings up at the top left from Galicia in northwest Spain, are almost certainly from the late Neolithic or the early Bronze Age period, around 2000 BC, but that could be a few hundred years or so either side. But because they're just carvings on a piece of rock, there's no scientific way of actually dating that carving. Radiocarbon doesn't work on those kinds of things. It's just design hammered into rock. The carvings up at the top right from the Italian Alps, from Val Camonica, are exactly the same design as the ones that you find in Galicia in northwest Spain. But we know that they probably only date to maybe 1000 BC at the oldest. But there's some room for revision there. The big problem with a lot of these early labyrinths is that archaeologists study them and come up with a set of dates, and then 10, 20 years on, another set of archaeologists come and revise those datings. So these datings are continually playing backwards and forwards. And at the moment, the best guess for labyrinths in Europe is that some of them are at least 2000 BC, 4,000 years old. The one that's actually the oldest where you can pin a precise date on it is the one at the bottom left from Pylos in Greece. And this is a clay tablet with the labyrinth design scratched on it. And notice these four here, although they're some of them, the entrance is at the top, some it's at the bottom, some of them are circular, some of them are square, all of those four examples there actually have exactly the same design, even though they come from England, Greece, Spain and Italy, and vary in age. The one from Pylos we know is exactly 1200 BC, give or take maybe 10 or 20 years, because it was found in the ruins of a Mycenaean palace that had been burnt down by fire. And the fire preserves carbon, which can be radiocarbon dated. So we know the exact age that the palace was destroyed. And when it was destroyed, there was a storeroom that contained clay tablets, which had been placed in the storeroom for storage, and it baked the tablets and turned them to ceramic, to pottery. It was just a chance event that preserved that selection of tablets that were in the storeroom on that day. Because the tablets themselves weren't kept. That tablet's not some magical spiritual object. It's kind of like a Bronze Age credit card, we see. When people came to the palace and delivered objects to the palace, the scribes would sit at the gates and record who came through the gates and what they had delivered. And in fact, the back of this tablet is actually a list of the goats that were delivered on one particular morning or one afternoon to the palace, and a list of the names of the people who delivered them. And then at the end of the day, they propped the tablet up in the sun and it would dry in the sun, and they put it in the storeroom. And they'd stay there for maybe a few weeks or a few months until the bills had been settled and people had been paid for the goats or the honey or the olive oil, whatever they were delivering. And then the tablets would crumble and fall apart. But by that time, everybody had been paid and nobody needed the receipt anymore. Just like the credit card receipts you stuff in your pocket today. Same kind of process. But because of the fire, it preserved them. And you can imagine the scribe maybe sitting there counting goats all day, and there were no more goats coming down the road, and he's turned the soft clay tablet over and literally just doodled the labyrinth design on the back of the tablet. Pure chance that we have it preserved. And that's really the story with a lot of these early examples of the labyrinth. Our knowledge of them is pure chance. It's an odd example that's been preserved here and there. And if we can date them, all the better. And then this one that's over here at the bottom right from Rocky Valley in England, you'd look at that and think that that looks just the same as those other carvings from Spain and from Italy. And indeed, the sign that's attached next to the rock face on that carving in Cornwall says that this carving probably dates to the Bronze Age and suggests a date of 1800 BC. But recent research suggests that that carving, in fact, dates to 1800 AD, a slight difference of 3,600 years. And in fact, it was probably carved about 200 years ago by the owner of the mill, that's the ruins of which stand next to the rock face on which the labyrinth is carved. The thing is that all of these simple labyrinths, and this design is what's often called the classical design, are always exactly the same. So dating them by any change in style is extremely difficult because the style never changes. And this is another one here. This is at Lusanus in Sardinia. This is in an underground Neolithic tomb. The tomb itself dates to about 2500 BC, and it's actually been carved into the rock underground. And the interior of these tombs are carved like the interiors of wooden houses. And the dead were buried in them. And on the wall of this particular tomb, the entrance is there at the top left, and top right is a view of the interior. That long stretch of wall in the middle of that photograph there is shown in some more detail at the bottom left, and you can see the carving that's on it, and the close-up of it on the right there is another of these labyrinth symbols. Now, some of the books that you read suggest that this labyrinth dates to 2500 BC and is in fact the oldest known labyrinth in Europe. But if you actually look at the carving style and compare it to the carvings that are actually in those tombs, it's far more likely that this particular labyrinth is Roman graffiti. So while it's probably still 2,000 years old, that's a big difference from 4,500. But once again, the big issue and the big problem here is that there's just no way of dating when that carving was put on the wall. You can often, with some of these sites really just give a best guess.
The term best guess actually speaks very well to the experience of finding this labyrinth, which I don't want to be right in front of. Sorry. The pilgrimage is a theme that is often associated with labyrinths. People feel sometimes like they've gone on a pilgrimage when all they've done is walk the paths of a very small labyrinth. Finding a labyrinth when it's out there in the remote fields can be a pilgrimage. We went here in 2005. It was for my 50th birthday. And I had said, I want a trip with no labyrinths. I just finished my doctoral dissertation. I didn't ever want to hear the word again. And I said, no labyrinths. And Jeff said, okay, just one. So speaking to Marla's experience of being taken out across the fields, we drove out through the snow-covered mountains and up to an abandoned factory and walked down a road and climbed over a chain-link fence and slid between two stone walls and walked through the factory and the abandoned factory and hoped that maybe there were no wild dogs in there protecting the abandoned premises, and climbed over the dead sheep carcass and walked down along the wall to the creek. And we had this map, this old picture of where this tomb was. And so we're holding it up like this, looking for skyline, you know, for trees and mountain shapes that would kind of have that same formation that was there in the picture. And we're like this, and we're going out over the fields, and we can hear the most amazing sound. The sheep wear bells that have bone clappers, and they rattle almost like wooden wind chimes, and they just carry in the wind, and they're beautiful. And along with them, you hear the wild barking of the dogs who are protecting the sheep. We're just praying that maybe there aren't any sheep in the field that we're trying to go into. I'm thinking, happy birthday, I'm going to get killed. So we go up and down and around and down by the creek and over and around, and we find this hole in the ground. And Jeff says, this is it, I know it is. And he's down that hole. You can see how inviting it is. Climbed down. I thought, okay, you know, I really need to be the supportive labyrinth enthusiast here. I'll jump down in that well, and I'll stick my head in. And Jeff's inside, and he's like, come here, sweetie, here it is. And there on the wall was this graffiti. And we had really, it was a quest, and we had found it. It was exciting, so we're hunkered down there, you know, roofs about here over our heads, and we're looking at it, tracing the path, trying to get an idea of its size, really trying to get a sense of who might have made it and when. And I realize there are wasp nests right at the top of the roof that are, you know, inches from my head. And you'll see there's a bat right there. That picture has the bat. Eventually we decided we needed to move it. And, you know, I'm from California. Bats have rabies. You know, you don't touch a bat. Jeff's picking it up very tenderly and putting it into a little antechamber. So that's the kind of adventure that we've been on, looking for these labyrinths. It's exciting, and there's something about it that connects us with labyrinth enthusiasts that have been the world over for the past thousands of years. There's something about the labyrinth symbol that draws on the imagination in such a way that people get hooked. There's just, you're here tonight, we've come all the way from England, we go all over the world looking for and speaking about labyrinths. There's something that captures the imagination and makes us want to know more. We resonate with it. So that's the story of the Luzana Labyrinth, and who knows who did it originally. We have, you know, we sat down there in the little cave speculating, thinking, well, you know, it could have been some traveler coming across these fields, taking refuge perhaps from a storm. It was very snowy and cold there at the time we were there in February. And there's something about going down into this chamber that's very reminiscent of the story of Theseus and the Minotaur. So that could have brought that story to mind, and he decided he knew how to draw a labyrinth, and he decided to sketch it into the wall. We don't know who made it. We don't know when it was made, as Jeff said. But there's something that links that unknown artist to us, and it's very sacred. It's very exciting. I think that's all I'll say about that now.
So the thing about all of these early labyrinths is that they're always the same design. In fact, if you look at practically all known examples of the labyrinth from the first 2,000 or more years of their history, they are in fact exactly all the same. And it's always therefore a good test that if there's any doubt about whether the design you're looking at is the labyrinth symbol, well, is it that design? Because if it's not, then it's not one. They are so consistent. And you can see from the little graphic here, see how it's drawn from a cross and a series of angles and dots at the centre, and then it's drawn by concentric circles that connect up those points. What you're actually drawing there is a spiral that runs through that cross arrangement at the centre. And those of you that are coming to Kimberly's workshop tomorrow will find out exactly how to draw this, and we'll get to practice it a few times. And once you have practiced it a few times and learnt it, you're unlikely to ever forget that process. And that really is the whole way, probably, in fact almost certainly, that this one symbol spread in prehistory across Europe, from one end of Europe to another, and indeed probably further afield than that, as we'll see. Because everybody has taught the next person how to draw it. And when you look at practically all of the examples from prehistory, and indeed even some quite modern ones, like these three examples on the right here, from 18th century England and Ireland, you can see that they all have that cross pattern at the centre. And often it's quite strongly emphasised, because those are the first lines that you draw, and then the angles, and then the dots at the corner, and then you connect them up. And wherever you find examples of this classical labyrinth design that have been constructed freehand rather than embellished by carving or somehow improving on the original sketch, wherever they're drawn freehand or laid in simple fashion, you can nearly always detect the method by which they're constructed. And where that shows, you will 99 times out of 100 find that exactly the same technique is being used to construct them. So this coin that's in the middle here is actually an English love token from the late 1700s. A copper coin that's been hammered flat and then engraved with initials and a little motto that were given to sweethearts by soldiers and sailors before they went out to war as a reminder for their sweethearts back at home. And condemned prisoners would also make them and sell them to the people who were coming to watch their executions. There's a rather bizarre twist on it to presumably to raise a bit of money for their last wishes before they were hung. And there's a number of these little tokens. This is one that's in my collection that I acquired on eBay a couple of years ago. From a dealer who didn't understand quite what it was. He said, it's a love token with a maze on the back of it. It's actually a fascinating thing, because if you study the design real closely under a microscope, once again you can see exactly the process by which all of the strokes of the engraving have been made. The one that's over on the top right there is in a medieval stone mine in southern England, although that's probably been done by a bunch of schoolboys that went down there in the 1730s and used this old abandoned underground stone mine as a secret drinking den. They knew where the entrances into the mine system were, and there's one section at the far, far end of the mine system, and there's 16 miles of galleries underground in the entire system. There's one section that's covered in all this chalk graffiti with names and dates, so we know who these people were, and we know they were all late teenagers, early 20s, so they're probably the young lads of the village. And also found down there are a number of clay tobacco pipes and several drinking vessels with excise marks on, which allow them to be dated quite precisely from the early 1700s. It was their secret den, but obviously they probably knew the story of Theseus and the Minotaur as well, and this was their descent into the underworld and their little secret meeting place. And maybe drawing the labyrinth on the wall was part of the initiation ceremony into joining the club, because there's a number of these labyrinths, and also these swastika, swastika patterns drawn on the walls. And most of them are correct, but a few of them have got errors in, which suggests that there was some kind of test being carried out there. Curious things. And like I say, nearly all these ones that you can see where they've been done freehand, that process there, that's how the labyrinth's been constructed. Wherever you find it around the world, you will always find that technique being used. And here's one that's recently turned up, and this one is really rather peculiar and forces some rethinking. This is in Goa in India, discovered a few years ago, and we went there last year to go and photograph it. This is a large labyrinth. You can see that there it is on the left there. And the local archaeologists reckon that this labyrinth probably dates to at least 2500 BC. Some of the archaeologists push it back to 4, 6, maybe even 8,000 BC, which seems a little fanciful. But certainly it would seem fair to assume the association of this labyrinth carving with the other carvings on the rock faces, like these animals, bulls and so forth, which are very much in a Neolithic style from around 2,000-3,000 BC. But this labyrinth is in fact 4,000 or 5,000 years old. But this one's quite different from the little carvings on the rock faces in Europe. You can see from the size of that, that labyrinth's actually 10 feet in diameter. It's actually big enough that you can walk round it very, very carefully on tippy toes. Totally different scale to anything we've ever found in Europe. How the labyrinth gets to be in India in 2500 BC and in Galicia in northwest Spain around about the same time is a big question. One of the big questions about the labyrinth is, does it have one point of origin and then spread worldwide from that point? Or is it indeed an archetypal form which has in fact a number of independent origin points? That's one of the big arguments in the study of labyrinths at the moment, and finds like this one that in Goa in India just kind of cause the arguments to rage a little longer. Very curious one indeed. And there's lots of other labyrinths in India. They're quite widespread, little known, but they occur in a number of forms. A number of them are laid on the ground using rocks. And it's a slightly different design to those ones that we've seen before from Europe. It has the spiral at the centre, but that's because it's drawn from a different process. Instead of drawing with a cross at the centre, it actually starts with a Y shaped at the centre. It has three arms instead of four. And when you then connect up the angles and the dots in a Y-shaped, what's known as the seed pattern at the centre of the labyrinth, the design you get is this one with the spiral at the centre. And this is actually quite a common one in India, and is often called the Chakra Viewer because of its connection to a story in the Mahabharata. So labyrinths are widespread in India, and they come in many shapes and sizes, but they're very difficult to find.
There are just a couple of things I want to tell you about. First of all, remembering back to the last slide, there was the picture of the rock panel, and Jeff showed you two of the animals that were carved nearby. Interestingly, and I like to tell this especially to audiences like this, there was also a carving of a woman giving birth right there in the same immediate vicinity, and a goddess figure that is recognized in Indian symbology. So clearly it was a very prominent and important place with some sacred something happening there at the time that those images were carved. India was fabulous. I'm going to start by telling you a story of this old one, the Lakshmana Mandal in Sidimani. That was probably one of the biggest reasons. The stone carving labyrinth and this one were the two that we really, really wanted to go see. And so we'd rented hired a car and driver, and he didn't speak English, but we'd been showing him the labyrinth, and you could see that imagination catching fire. And pretty soon he's getting into it, and he goes out and finds another guide who speaks the local dialect, and we go off in search of this labyrinth. All we had was a picture of it from the 1930s to go on. We had no other information. We knew it was in some general area, and we kind of honed it down and honed it down and honed it down and took off. There had recently been a dam built. And so we saw the dam, we were impressed by it, and we were thinking, oh dear, this doesn't look good. So we found the little village, and basically it was a new little village because the old one had been wiped out by the reservoir, which had been created when the dam was built. And so we went on up the hillside to this new village, and we found the temple, and we found the priest there. He spoke almost no English, you know, hello. That was probably about the extent of his vocabulary in English, and we spoke none of his dialect at all. But, you know, you manage to talk. When something's important, hearts speak to hearts. And he was just, no, you know, and we've kind of drawn it out. It wasn't here anymore. That was clear. And we started to get out in the car, and the woman that was traveling with us said, well, maybe we could put a new labyrinth here. And so we all got back out of the car, and bear in mind, it's about 110 degrees. I'm going to get back in the car. And we go up, and we kind of start tracing it, and he gets all excited. And so we had some sidewalk chalk, and he found us a place, and we started drawing one on the patio there. And his wife goes into some bathroom and comes out with his diaries. And before he showed us the diaries, he took his pen and his paper, and he drew a picture of the old Sidamani labyrinth, not the walls, which are what we usually draw, but the path as he would have walked it. And then he showed us his journal, and it was dated, and in that he had captured the drawing of that labyrinth from his own perspective, because it was so important to him that this symbol that he had been the caretaker for so many years not die out. He wanted it remembered in some way. So he, you know, he had tears, we had tears. And he showed us, you know, these drawings he'd made just before the area was flooded and covered with water. Really an incredible experience, probably one of the most meaningful and deeply touching experiences I've ever had. The week before, we had been in Mumbai, where we had been invited to go and visit the IIT campus and help construct a labyrinth. That was the purpose of the trip, although we had lots of ulterior motives. This was the labyrinth. They had cleared the land. It was put on the side of an ancient temple. Just an incredible thing. And afterwards, we were allowed to go into some of the schools and talk with the kids. You know, they have an incredible spirituality. It's just a spiritual presence there. The women that we had been talking to while we'd been building the labyrinth had been intrigued by the idea that this was the symbol that was referred to in the, and I can never say it, Mahabharata. I don't know if it's his accent or my just not being able to say it. It never comes out right. The Mahabharata. That you can actually go and read about this defense, this battle formation, which is an ancient labyrinth. And so when we helped them build this labyrinth, the women were saying, this is the information that we've needed. We needed you to come to bring us this information so that we could share our story with you. It was such a cultural connection. And that's what seems to happen. There's a community that grows and builds when people come together around the labyrinth. There's something, you know, I talked about the imagination, it's also about community. We went into the schools, as I was saying, and the kids there were getting ready for their exams. Now, in England, where we live now, exams are a big deal. Everything focuses on the exams at the end of the year, and it's high pressure. Well, India is the same, only more so. So these kids were getting ready for their lab or for their exams, and we'd come in and we were taking some of their time, and they were interested and they were polite. We drew it, we showed them how to draw it, and then we talked with them just a little bit. That, you know, the language barrier was there, but we were getting around it. And we said to them, well, what might you walk a labyrinth for? How might you use a labyrinth? And they talked about their fears of exams, and together we came to the idea that going to the labyrinth might be a place where they could go and get centered, because they were so aware that the knowledge already resided within them. Their challenge was not to cram information, but to retouch and revisit and access the information that they already had inside them in order to pass their exams. And I was so moved by that. Afterwards, we traveled on. We spent, you know, another few weeks in India, And when we got back, we heard from the woman who lives there and who had organized the installation of this labyrinth that the students, the week of their exams, would go down to the temple in the mornings and walk that labyrinth. Now, I don't know how they did on them, but clearly they got the connection with using the labyrinth as a vehicle for touching into that wisdom which is already within. And I thought that that was a very remarkable thing for young people to be able to express so clearly.
So labyrinths, as I said, were widespread in India. On the left there, you find a lot of labyrinths in old manuscripts. This one from Rajasthan. A lot of them are actually magical spells. And one very popular one is the drawing of the labyrinth as an aid during childbirth. That women would draw the labyrinth on a polished plate, a metal sheet or a metal plate, using saffron powder, and then wash the labyrinth into a bowl and then drink the fluid, because supposedly the construction of the labyrinth was symbolic of the birth process, of the complicated travel of the baby down the birth canal, and that by being able to draw the labyrinth, that would ease the birth of the child, because it would be showing the child the way out into the world. Quite common in manuscripts in India, particularly 17th, 18th century. And it's presumably from India that labyrinths spread further afield to Indonesia, because you find labyrinths amongst a number of remote tribes in Java and Sumatra. On the right there is a painting of a labyrinth on a bark panel, a magical text from the Batak tribe in northern Sumatra. And for the Batak, the labyrinth was actually a spirit trap. It was a design that they used as a means of containing the Jonah, who were tricksters. They were troublesome spirits who would enter the village at night and steal things, or unlock the gates and let the livestock out, or steal things from the houses. And knowing how to draw the labyrinth was a way of containing the tricksters, the troublesome spirits, called the Jonah. And you find a number of these labyrinths on these magical texts. Most of them actually are no longer, of course, in Sumatra, but they're actually in museums. So I believe there's one in the Smithsonian here in America, I believe. There's a number of them in the British Museum, and quite a collection of them in museums in the Netherlands, because obviously Sumatra was the Dutch Indies, and Dutch sailors and traders would swap these magical texts for firearms and axes and things with these head-hunting tribes up in the mountains. And fortunately, therefore, some of these old things have actually been preserved. So we kind of suspect that the labyrinths that you find in Indonesia have got there through trade from India. But there's other parts of the world where you find labyrinths that are rather more difficult to explain, like the labyrinths that are here in America, down in the southwest. You find them principally in Arizona and New Mexico. And there's a few in the Sonoran region of northern Mexico as well. And it's the design which, if you've ever been down the southwest, you'll see called the Man in the Maze design. Over there on the right is one of the woven baskets that's produced with the Man in the Maze design. The man that stands at the entrance at the top there is known as Itoi. And he was the founding father of the tribes that live in the deserts in southern Arizona, on the border with Mexico and in parts of New Mexico. And the labyrinth symbol, because that's precisely what it is, the design that's there on that basket, is exactly the same as the labyrinths that you find in Europe. It's exactly the same as the labyrinths that are on those tree bark manuscripts from Sumatra. This was the pattern of the path that led to the house where Itoi lived. And as I said, Itoi was the founding father of the tribes. But once he'd founded the tribes and gone through a number of adventures, he retreated to the top of the mountain where he lives to this day and keeps an eye on the tribes and occasionally comes down to interfere and mess with things. But when he does, anybody that tries to follow him back to where he lives at the top of the mountain is so confused by the twists and the turns on the path that lead to the top of the mountain that they can never find where he lives. And the labyrinth symbol is a depiction of the pathway. Now, how this symbol got to the American Southwest, and it's only basically in Arizona and New Mexico and a few parts of northern Mexico, where you actually find the labyrinth symbol amongst Native American people. How it got there is another one of these big questions. Is it another of these independent discoveries of the archetypal labyrinth symbol, or has it in fact been introduced by the Spanish? It's a fair bet that the design itself got to the American Southwest with Jesuit priests sometime in the 1600s, who would have been very familiar with the symbol. But it was applied to a story and a symbolism that was already well known and widespread in the area. But another one of those questions that rages on. And on the left there is a petroglyph, a rock carving of the labyrinth symbol from near Taos in New Mexico. Same design again, slightly simpler version of it. Southwest that are much more difficult to date. Some of them could be around about the time of the first contact between Europeans and the native people in the Southwest. The question is, just which side of about the time do they fall? It makes a big difference. But back in Europe, labyrinths from some of those early ones that I showed you went through a long and complex history and an evolution. All of those ones that I've shown you there so far all had essentially exactly the same design. The ones in India are slightly different, but they're all drawn by the same process. But in Europe, about 2,000 years ago, the design started to evolve and a whole series of new labyrinths came along. So the labyrinth, the simple square classical labyrinth or a circular form of it that's on the coin on the left there from Knossos from around 200 BC, is that original labyrinth. But over on the right is a large mosaic from Salzburg in Austria from around 300 AD, one of about 60 or 70 Roman mosaic labyrinths that have been preserved, some of them better than others. But this labyrinth is much more complicated. You can see it's got a fourfold symmetry. The entrance is actually way over there on the right-hand side. And if you kind of follow it, it's a red line that runs through the middle of the path. You'll see that what actually happens is that the path fills, you work your way all through one quadrant of the labyrinth, then you skip to the next one, then to the next one, then to the next one, and into the centre. And there's a number of different types of these Roman labyrinths that come up with different ways of getting around the design. But a lot of them have this fourfold symmetry, which is quite different from those earlier labyrinths. And indeed, it's one of these Roman designs that found its way into the Christian church. This is what we think at the moment is the first Christian labyrinth. It's actually in a basilica in Algeria and is still preserved. It dates to about 324 AD. And it's a Roman mosaic labyrinth just laid in the floor of the basilica. And it's a typical Roman design. The path that comes in at the entrance goes all through the bottom right-hand quadrant and then the next one and the next one before eventually coming to the centre. But the square at the centre, you can see, is filled with letters. And this is a word square, which you can read those letters in various different directions, and what they spell out is Sancta Ecclesia, Holy Church. And in fact, you can read it in numerous different ways. I'm working with a mathematician at the moment on a paper. I think he says there's something like 3,274 ways in which you can draw lines through all of those characters and spell out the word Sancta Ecclesia. I'll believe him, but he's writing me the proof on it, which I will publish. So the labyrinth, which up until this point had been a pagan symbol, because it had been around for 2,000 years before Christianity, at least 2,000 years before Christianity, found its way kind of almost by chance into the Christian world. And from the early Christian world across Europe, we find a number of labyrinths, after the Romans had gone, carved on rocks. The one that's bottom left there, the Holywood Stone in Ireland, is on a large boulder which originally stood at the start of a pilgrimage trackway that led through a mountain pass to a monastery in Ireland, one of the earliest monasteries set up by St. Kevin in the 6th century. The stone, if it dates from the time of the founding of the monastery, or even if it's a short while after, because once again it's in very difficult to date, would suggest that here the labyrinth is being used as a symbol for the pilgrimage along the trackway. It's a paved road that runs for about 20 miles through the mountains and twists and turns and eventually comes to the monastery. Maybe the labyrinth is saying here, look, the road is long and tortuous, but follow the path and you'll reach the goal, much like the design of the labyrinth itself. And there's another one there from Spain. Once again, early Christian, but we really don't understand what its purpose is. And one from Turkey, which has a Christian inscription alongside it, which dates it quite clearly to the 6th or 7th century from the script that goes with it. And shortly after that, we start to find lots of labyrinths turning up in early Christian manuscripts. Labyrinths were being used as a symbol of a number of things in early Christian thinking. Some of them were being used as a symbol of the tortuous pathway through life, of the errors and bad habits that you could fall into, and the fact that you had to follow the one true path to reach your salvation. Some of them were actually being used, like the one over on the bottom right there, on early maps of the world. So this one that's on the Map of Mundi in Hereford in England is actually a drawing of a labyrinth on the island of Crete, because the medieval monks and clerics and scholars knew full well the story of Theseus and the Minotaur. And the one in the middle there from Regensburg still has Theseus fighting the Minotaur at the centre. Even though that's an old pagan story, they still knew all about it and put the depiction at the centre of these labyrinths. But you'll notice that some of these designs are changing again. Some of them, look at the top left there from Abruzzi in Italy, are that old classical labyrinth symbol, the one from the prehistoric period. But some of them once again have this fourfold symmetry, rather like the Roman labyrinths. But if you follow the pathway with your eye, you'll see that it's a much more complicated pattern. But it has that fourfold symmetry in it, that symbol of the Christian world. It's almost as if they took the prehistoric labyrinth symbol and kind of hybridized it with the Roman fourfold labyrinth, but came up with a labyrinth that was suitable and appropriate for use in a Christian context. And indeed, the one at the bottom left there from Abingdon, England, actually has a prayer written around it, which is interesting because you can actually read it in two different ways. You can either read it by concentrically from the pathways, or you can read it by following the pathway itself. And both versions of the prayer make sense. It's a prayer to the Virgin Mary. Dates to about 1000 AD. Clearly, by that time, the labyrinth had been absorbed within Christian thinking. And it wasn't long after that that labyrinths underwent a whole new evolution and changed their shape and their use again. Because in the Christian world up to this time, they're just in manuscripts. They're just scratched on rocks and things like that. But then labyrinths started to find their way into churches and cathedrals. So it starts in 12th century Italy, where you find labyrinths carved on walls, like the one here at Lucca Cathedral, or laid as little floor mosaics, like the one at Pavia. Not big enough to walk, but big enough to follow by eye, or like the one at Lucca, to follow with your finger. If any of you are familiar with sort of modern labyrinth products, you may have seen finger labyrinths, like wooden boards with labyrinths carved in them that you can follow with a fingertip or roll a marble around. Here's a finger labyrinth from the 12th century carved on the wall of a cathedral in Italy. You can actually just trace it with your finger. In fact, there used to be an inscription at the centre, but so many people have traced it over the years that it's worn the inscription away. And from those labyrinths that started to appear in Italy in the 12th century as small ornaments, carvings on walls, in the 13th century they started to be built in the cathedrals in northern France, particularly around Paris, where many new cathedrals were being built in what is now called the Gothic style. And a number of those cathedrals had labyrinths built in them. Several dozen probably in total, but of them only a handful survive, and this by far is the most famous, the beautifully preserved example that's in Chartres Cathedral. Far more complicated than most of the labyrinths, but actually has a very specific design up there at the top left. This labyrinth design has beautiful mathematical symmetry, far too complicated to go into here. But basically, when you follow the path of that labyrinth, the first half of the moves that you make as you go around the design are the exact mirror image of the last half. So as you walk into the labyrinth, you make one set of moves and then it's mirror image, and then you get to the centre and then you come out and repeat that process all over again. Beautifully, beautifully mathematical. And very carefully thought out. It's very difficult to make these designs mathematically symmetrical. In fact, there's only really one solution, and this is it. And they knew that solution over 1,000 years ago. And this is the one that you find in a lot of the cathedrals in northern France. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. But most people go to Chartres and all they see is the chairs. You can see the chairs in the distance there. Normally, when you go to Chartres Cathedral, those chairs extend all the way over the labyrinth, and it's just that little strip down the centre. In fact, most of the tour parties that are taken around Chartres Cathedral march straight across it and don't even realise it. The number of people I know who've said, well, I went to Chartres Cathedral, but I didn't see no labyrinth there, because they didn't go on a Friday, which is currently the day when the chairs are taken out of the nave. But this being France and it being Chartres Cathedral, next year it will probably be a Tuesday. They change it all the time, just to confuse folks, I'm sure. So from the one at Chartres, which became very influential, a number of other labyrinths have been built across northern France. This one at St. Quentin in near Amiens to the north of Paris still survives. And this one, that was at St. Quentin. This is Amiens itself. The original labyrinth was built in the late 1200s, but it was destroyed in 1825. But there was such an uproar from the local historical society that eventually a replica of it was relaid in 1894. So there is now this beautiful polished marble labyrinth in Amiens Cathedral, an exact replica of the original. Really quite beautifully done, and one that's well worth going to see. And once again, it's often covered in chairs, but nowhere near as often as the one at Chartres. Would you want to say anything? And then There's not just the ones that are laid in the floors. They occur in all kinds of other situations. So up here at the top left, a labyrinth is a roof boss. One that's on a lectern in Cathedral at Volterra in Italy. Carved on the wall of a church in Ireland, and made as floor tiles in France. All kinds of uses of the labyrinth as both a large symbolic object on the floor, which clearly was designed to be walked, and lots of people have written lots about how these labyrinths were being used. There's this notion that priests would walk around them on their knees in solemn prayer to absolve their sins or some such. Or that pilgrims would walk the labyrinth in gratitude for getting safely to the cathedral. And all of those things could be true, but the only documents we actually have about how the labyrinths in the French cathedrals, at any rate, were being used is a set of legal proceedings that accompanied the destruction of one of the labyrinths at Auxerre. The canons of the cathedral wanted the labyrinth removed from the cathedral because they considered it to be an unchristian practice. But the priests wanted to continue to play the ball game that they played on the labyrinth at Easter. And in the court proceedings, there is a full account of how the game was played and the rules and the music and all of the details. And it seems that basically at Easter the priests would play ball games on the labyrinth by dancing around the labyrinth with musical accompaniment and throwing the ball backwards and forwards to each other from opposite sides of the labyrinth. A very, very strange and rather unchristian sounding practice, and no wonder that the canons wanted to wipe it out, although it's probable actually that the canons actually wanted to stop it because they were responsible for paying for the food and the drinks that had to be supplied after the dancing on the labyrinth. So there's lots and lots of these labyrinths from the sort of medieval period, and certainly in central and southern Europe, lots and lots of them have these new complicated designs, what are called medieval designs, and the one at Chartres is by far the most famous. But there's another group of labyrinths up in the far north, which also occur in churches, but they're painted on walls and ceilings. But these are all the old classical labyrinth design. They're not the medieval design at all, because up there in the far north of Scandinavia, there really weren't too many books around or plans for how to draw these labyrinths. So all of these labyrinths were being drawn by people who knew the design in their head, because they'd learnt that old technique of drawing the cross at the centre and connecting up all the loops. And you can see it clearly on this one over on the left here from Ruslev, where the centre cross and the little rings on at the corners are painted in red, and the first set of circles at the top, because that's where you always start, are in red, but then they switch to a different colour, they go to blue. Some debate about whether the artist that's painting the frescoes on the ceiling did it deliberately to show how the design was constructed, or whether more likely he ran out of red paint halfway through and rather than go down and mix up a new set of paint, just switch to a different colour pot and finish the design off, but in the process recorded exactly how he was drawing the design. And that labyrinth design is found throughout Scandinavia. In fact, there's over 600 labyrinths recorded from Scandinavia of all different types, but mostly laid out of rocks on the ground. And because it's Scandinavia and some of them up in the high Arctic, basically, unless somebody comes along and moves those rocks, they survive. They just sit there. So here's, for instance, a few of them. One from Visby on Gotland, one from Dritvik on Iceland, on the flanks of the Snæfells volcano, and a modern one from Denmark, with people dancing it around a maypole. There's this long tradition of using labyrinths in Scandinavia that probably goes back to the late Iron Age, certainly the time of the Romans, maybe 2,000, at least 1,500 years ago, and those labyrinths continued to be built and used throughout that period, right up to modern times. And as I say, it's left us in the region of 500-600 labyrinths throughout Scandinavia, from Iceland through Norway, Sweden, Finland, Estonia, and up into Arctic Russia and around the White Sea, which are still available for study. This one here is on a remote island in the Stockholm archipelago and was probably built by fishing communities. They used to build labyrinths and walk them before they'd set out to sea, because supposedly fishermen were very superstitious, and they believed that when things went wrong when they were out on the boat, it was because the trolls had come with them. It was the trolls that ripped holes in the net. It was trolls that caused bad weather. So the fishermen supposedly would walk these labyrinths before setting out to sea, and trolls, being superstitious, would follow them in. Once they got to the centre, the fishermen knew the design, and they ran back out and left the trolls trapped inside and jumped in the boats and set out to sea. And there's lots of this Swedish and Finnish folklore about how the labyrinths were used, how they were used to control the weather, how they were used to ward off attacks by dangerous animals, by bears and wolverines, how they were just used for good luck. But everywhere you find these fishing camps and settlements, you find these labyrinths built next to them. Curious things. And some of them are now far inland, because the changes in the sea level there mean that labyrinths that were once built next to the coast, because the land is rising rapidly out of the sea, some of them can now be a mile or two inland. But that gives you a good clue to how old they are. And some of them, like this one here in Arctic Russia, are on very remote islands, far, far from land, where nobody has ever lived. They're sites where the Lapps, the Sami, would go to offer... they'd make sacrifices to their ancestors. They'd go and make offerings to the spirits of the animals that they hunted. And they made mounds of stones and left offerings in them. Some of those sites are accompanied by huge labyrinths. I mean, some of these are in the region of 70, 80 feet across. They have mounds of stones that are knee high. They've probably been built over the course of hundreds of years, with each person that came there adding more rocks to the labyrinth. We really don't understand what those ones are all about. And it's only really in the last few years that we've been able to get access to some of these places up in the far north of Russia to go study them. So I'll stop at that point, because apparently it's now time for some refreshments. And once we've had the refreshments, we'll come back and show you a few more examples of labyrinths, and a few that show you how labyrinths aren't just about the past, but how in the last 20 years or so, they've suddenly become a dynamic force again. Up until now, a lot of the labyrinths that we've looked at, the ones that are in the churches and the cathedrals, even some of the early prehistoric ones, appear to be being used in spiritual ways, the ones particularly in the churches and the cathedrals. But during the 16th century, labyrinths evolved again, and actually started being used for a number of secular purposes. So this one here at Ghent in Belgium, for instance, is in the courthouse in the town hall in Ghent, and fills the floor of what was the central court for the city. And there, maybe the labyrinth is actually representing the true path of justice rather than the true path to salvation. And top left there, one that's in the Castel Sant'Angelo in Italy, is actually in a series of rooms built by the popes in the 1500s. It's actually in their treasury room. And on the labyrinth that fills the floor of the room were large wooden chests that contained all the wealth and the jewels of the popes. There, maybe the labyrinth is actually symbolising a protective design to guard the wealth of the Christian church in Rome. And at the bottom there is a design for a labyrinth, which is in fact exactly the same as the one that's in the Castel Sant'Angelo, and also this one at San Vitale in Ravenna. All date, you see, from 1537, 1540s, 1546. The labyrinth design at the bottom there by Serlio was actually not in a book that tells you how to create a labyrinth in your church or your treasure room or your storerooms, but how to create a labyrinth in your garden, because this was one of the first gardening books. And indeed, it was at this time that labyrinths started to be built in gardens, because they were being recommended as something that is ideal to construct in your garden, something to aspire to, you know, much like decking is in your garden today, or, you know, water features and things like this. And it was at this time that labyrinths started to be laid out in early formal gardens. And at first they were built in low hedging, box hedging, things like that, but also in other things that grew a bit faster and grew a bit taller. And it's during the late 15th century and 16th century, around that early 1500s period, that we first start to find the designs of what look like labyrinths, but there's actually a few choices in the pathways. Because if you can imagine a labyrinth laid flat on the ground, two-dimensional or relatively two-dimensional, there's little point in having choice in the paths, because you can see where the paths are going. But once they grow up to a height where you can't see over them, then put choices in, and then you can start confusing people. And it's around that time, around 500 years ago, that you start to find in some of the early books and the manuscripts plans of what we would call mazes, particularly hedge mazes and garden mazes. And once they'd kind of been freed from their two-dimensionality and became three-dimensional, the designs evolved quite rapidly and became ever, ever more complex. So back in the 1500s, most of the hedge mazes actually look like labyrinths that just have one pathway, but with just a couple of choices. But once you get to the 1600s and the 1700s, they get really quite complicated, like this one bottom right here from Strahl in Italy from the 1720s. Much, much more complicated. Ones at the top there, relatively simple looking, but quite difficult to find your way around from the early 1800s, because it was in the early 1800s that mathematicians started to look at the designs of mazes and worked out the rules for how to solve them. And, you know, up until that time, practically all of the hedge mazes that had been built could be solved by always walking around and keeping one hand on the wall. You know, that always turn to the left rule, or always turn to the right. Because the maze is actually all one big long hedge that eventually gets to the centre, if you always turn in the same direction or keep your hand, it might be the longest way of getting there, but you'll eventually follow the hedge into the centre. And it was in the early 1800s that mathematicians started to play with these things and realised that if you build the centre of the maze as a completely separate unit from the outside, and then build another one around that and have islands stacked within islands, anyone that tries that always turn left or always turn right is simply going to go in, go round and come straight back out again. They're never going to get to the centre. And that's really been the way that mazes have continued to this current day. Now some of the mazes that are being built are enormous. So, you know, if you've seen these corn mazes, some of those cover, sort of something like about sort of 15 or 20 acres. But, you know, they take hours to walk around. Some folk come back several consecutive days to try to solve them. They have portable toilets, you know, installed in them and things like that. And there's this arms race between the designers of them to come up with ever bigger ones and more complicated ones to get into the Guinness Book of Records and all that stuff. Mazes have really gone off at a tangent, but bear in mind that 500 years ago, the overlap, the difference between labyrinths with one path and mazes with many paths was very difficult to distinguish. Nowadays, it's rather more simple. So From that same period, we have lots of labyrinths in England, turf labyrinths cut into the ground, most of them the same designs as the one from the cathedrals in France, but we know that most of them were built from the 15 and 1600s, and lots of them were built as probably entertainment for children and young people. It was a youth centre for the time. It was somewhere where people would go and dance. There were rules about how you would dance around these labyrinths. There were quite complex rituals that kind of built up around meeting and dancing at these labyrinths, and rules about how they had to be run and walked. How the young women would stand at the centre and the men would race each other around the paths to get to the girls. And wages in gallons of beer and things like that. There would have been hundreds of these in the British Isles, and just 8 of them still survive. They're now all historic monuments, obviously. So this one here at Julian's Bower in Orpah in Lincolnshire in northern England has this beautiful view out across the point where the three main rivers that drain the east coast of England come together and meet, and it's on the hilltop overlooking this. Probably about 500 years old. I can try that. I don't want to get feedback from it. Do you want to adjust that? So yeah, so this one, probably about 500 years old. They're very difficult to date, but it's sunk in a hollow in the ground where cutting the turf away and removing the soil has gradually lowered the labyrinth into the ground over the course of hundreds of years. And this one, which is our local labyrinth in Essex where we live, is huge. It's 132 feet across. The pathway is actually a mile long from the entrance, which is down on the bottom right there where the little signpost is, to the mound at the centre. Lots of these labyrinths say that the path is a mile long. This is probably just about the only one where that's actually true. And then from those labyrinths, 1600s, something happened 150 years ago that brought labyrinths back to life again, because the whole story of labyrinths is ebb and flow. At different stages in their history, they've become popular and then they've fallen out of fashion. So we saw the ones that were being built by the Romans, we saw the ones that were being used by the early Christians and in the medieval cathedrals, the ones that were on the village greens in England, the ones that are in the courthouses and so forth. In the middle of the 19th century, there was a lot of development of religion in Europe. For the first time, it became possible to go to the church of your choice. So there were lots of new chapels and new churches being built, and lots of the old churches and cathedrals were restored. And in the 1840s, the cathedral at St. Omer was being restored. And they built a replica of an old labyrinth that used to be at the monastery, at the abbey in St. Omer, half the size of the original, but an exact copy, and laid it in front of the high altar in the cathedral. Now, that one became very influential because a writer on French architecture wrote a book about the cathedral and mentioned the labyrinth and gave a drawing of it. Well, those architectural books then got copied, and labyrinths once again became popular in books on architecture. So you had this whole new generation of architects who were building and restoring churches and cathedrals and reading the textbooks about the subject that said labyrinths are an important part of medieval architecture. So they started building them in churches and chapels all over Europe. This one's at Guingamp in Brittany from the 1850s. Do you want to have just a quick word on that one?
You can see the statue back behind the banks of flowers and candles. Jeff wanted to... We'd been in Chartres. We had been visiting with the Black Madonna. We had been walking the labyrinth. Had a wonderful week. Well, he wanted to go and find this labyrinth because he hadn't seen it. And I was interested in researching the Black Madonna. And our interests converged. And as you can see, there is a Black Madonna standing as guardian over this little labyrinth built on the porch of the church. And one of the things that touched me so deeply was that this was a living shrine. We wanted to photograph it, of course. And as we were standing there trying to get in a position to get a good picture, we were continually interrupted by a stream of people, one person after another, male and female. Too close. Okay, better? Continually interrupted by a stream of people, young and old, male and female, coming by to walk across the labyrinth. They didn't follow the pathway, but that's not always done in France anyway, but to walk across the labyrinth, to light a candle, and to kiss the hem of the Virgin's robe. And it was so clearly a part of daily life, not just a Sunday-only observance, that this really cemented in my mind the connection between the Black Madonna and the labyrinth. And I think that that's another area that deserves a lot more consideration and research in the future.
Another one here from Itchinstoke in southern England is a replica of the labyrinth in Chartres Cathedral, but made in little tiny green and brown tiles. It's a manufactured labyrinth. All of these tiles have been stamped and colour glazed and then laid. It's tiny. You can see the altar table standing on it. But the chapel itself, which is now a redundant chapel but preserved and cared for, is based on the design of the Sainte-Chapelle in Paris, but in miniature. And quite appropriately, it has a miniature replica of the labyrinth at Chartres, laid underneath the altar. 1866, this one. Here's another one, 1870, in Ely Cathedral in England. Curious design, but it fills the space under the west tower of the cathedral. George Gilbert Scott, who was the architect responsible for restoring the cathedral, had been to Chartres and to Amiens and seen the labyrinths there and built a labyrinth in Ely Cathedral when he did his restoration. Although you'd look at it now and think it's been there for a long time. Do you want to tell the strange story of this one?
Well, it hasn't been here very long. It was here long enough to have created its own local lore and local mythology. Legend has it that the devil came to visit Ely Cathedral. Now, Ely Cathedral has a beautiful long nave and the ceilings are painted. It's absolutely stunning. As you look down towards the high altar, it's marvelous. Well, the devil came and opened the door, and it's a big, massive cathedral door, and he saw that high altar down at the end, and he thought, I'll have that for my own, thank you. And so he walked into the cathedral, and he, of course, was met by the labyrinth. Well, you know, whatever you might say about him, the devil does follow rules. And so he stepped onto the path, and he began walking. He walked, and he walked, and he walked, and he walked. And, of course, he came to the center. Well, still following the rules, still following the path, he walked, and he walked, and he walked, and he walked back to the entrance. By then, of course, he was facing back out of the labyrinth and out of the door. Never looking back, he walked out of the door of the cathedral, and that's why the devil never took Ely Cathedral for his own. Labyrinth is a threshold guardian.
So although it was only built 130 years ago, this modern folklore has become attached to this labyrinth. Indeed, the guides that, you know, that take you around the cathedral will tell you the story as if it's, you know, from the dawn of time, but clearly it's quite a modern piece. But it shows really nicely how the symbolism of the labyrinth and the mythology and all of these stories combine and recombine over and over again. Wherever you get these things, these stories attach to them. And here's probably one of the strangest groups of labyrinths anywhere. This is the Watts Chapel, just to the south of London. There's five labyrinths on this chapel that was built as a memorial to George Frederick Watts, a famous Victorian sculptor and painter. The building is just outrageous. It is covered in this Celtic Art Nouveau terracotta carving, gilded panels, just about everything that the Victorians could do, they threw at this one. And for many years, it was kind of considered to be in such poor taste that none of the books on Victorian architecture even dared mention this place. Within the last 20 years or so, there's something of a revival of appreciation of the Victorian arts and crafts movement, and now this is hailed as one of the triumphs of the age. And it has five labyrinths tucked on the building. The challenge is to walk round and find them. There's just so much ornament on it. Incredible thing. And here's a really bizarre one from the 1920s, built in a bombed-out church in northern France near Amiens that was totally destroyed during the First World War. And when they rebuilt the church in the 1920s, when they finally finished it and put a new floor in 1927, they kind of put in a copy of the labyrinth that's at Ghent, or maybe the one that's at St. Omer, but they didn't really understand the design and it had to fill the whole floor of the church. So it's kind of, it looks like those labyrinths from St. Omer and Ghent at the bottom, but it's strange. It's actually a maze rather than a labyrinth. But this was kind of like the poor man's version of it, just in this little church out in the French countryside. But kind of takes it beyond the end of the 19th century and into the early 20th century. And interestingly, takes it within a year or so of this one that's in Riverside Church in Manhattan, that was built in 1928, 1929. It's the first church labyrinth in America, built by the Rockefellers, who sent their architects to Chartres to study the cathedral there, and built the church at Riverside, and built this little labyrinth in front of the high altar. And later in the 20th century, in fact, really within the last 40, 50 years, labyrinths have continued to bubble beneath the surface and then started to boil over again. In the 1950s at Whit-Rissington in England, a priest there had a dream of a labyrinth and built a labyrinth in his garden with the Stations of the Cross marked around it. And it was there for about 20 or 30 years until he retired, at which point everybody thought, well, he's gone now, we can get rid of that. But at the same time, there were architects taking the labyrinth symbol, like the one in the centre. This is a door handles on a church in Donegal in Ireland. They've taken that classical labyrinth symbol, the prehistoric one, and emphasised the Christian cross at the centre there. And it's the door handles on the church. In 1977, one was built in the crypt of Cologne Cathedral, during some restoration work there. One at Bath Eastern in England, built in 1985 by the priest, sort of in the early 80s, sort of trendy priests. He was interested in dance, so he built a labyrinth on the floor of his church, and it's still there. I don't think too many people in the village really quite understand why it's there, but it's a kind of landmark in this modern revival, these ones from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, because then in early 1990s, in fact 1992, a labyrinth was laid in Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. It was done just as a temporary thing, painted on canvas for the New Year celebrations, by the Reverend Lauren Artress, who'd studied with Jean Houston and had been to Chartres and seen the labyrinth there. And they painted a copy of the labyrinth at Chartres and laid it out on the floor of the cathedral for people to come and walk at New Year's Eve. And hundreds of people came and walked it. And in fact, it was so popular that lots of people asked, well, would they put it out again the following night for those that didn't get a chance that night? And then the following night, and the following night, and it got into the local newspapers. These people walking this labyrinth thing in Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. And from the local newspapers, it then got into the media and got national coverage. And then people were phoning up Grace Cathedral and saying, this labyrinth thing, can you bring it to our church? And within the space of just a few years, from this one that was placed on the floor of Grace Cathedral, there were lots and lots of copies of this labyrinth being painted on canvas and taken portable labyrinths. You know, something quite new. All the labyrinths really up to this time had been placed at one particular point and used in just that location. Now they were being painted on canvas and on sheets of polyvinyl coated fabric, on parachute silk, all kinds of things, so that they could be packed up and put in a trunk or put in a box or taken somewhere else and laid out for another group of people in a different place at a different time. A whole new concept in how labyrinths were being used. And people started building labyrinths again on a really big scale. You know, when you look at the labyrinths in medieval France in those cathedrals, there was maybe a couple of dozen of them. Those labyrinths up in Scandinavia, well, there was 500 or 600 of them built probably over 500 years or so. The ones in England, maybe a couple of hundred of those. A conservative estimate is that within the last 10 or 15 years, there's been somewhere in excess of 10,000 labyrinths built, probably just here in the USA and Canada alone. That's a really phenomenal increase. And represents a whole new wave of interest in them. And the same's happened with mazes at the same time, which have had their periods of popularity in the past, back in the 1500s when they were in gardens, back in the 1800s when they were put into pleasure parks and amusement arcades and all these kinds of things. They are now becoming popular again. Lots of people bringing new technology, building really complicated new mirror mazes, the big corn mazes, hundreds and hundreds of them being built every year, albeit that they're just temporary. So there's all kinds of new labyrinths being built for all kinds of different purposes. Top right there, in a forest in Scotland, it's an art installation. It's a big labyrinth, but those big standing stones, 80 of them taken from all the major geological formations around Scotland and erected as standing stones around the labyrinth. The one at the top left is used for weddings at a house in Illinois. The one at the bottom right is on the island of Iona. This one here is in a private garden, and has lights hidden in the bushes around it so that you can walk it at night. Albeit it's an exact replica of the labyrinth at Chartres, but 115% in scale to make the paths a little wider and easier to walk. And labyrinths have been used not just for spiritual and adult purposes, but for children. Here, some labyrinths from Denmark, for instance, in children's playgrounds, in school playgrounds, to introduce children to the idea of labyrinths, both for their historical aspect, for their mathematical and geometric aspects, and just to get them out in the playground or out onto the playing field to get some exercise. And the children love them, and they love building them, because once they've built them, it's their labyrinth, and they look after it and protect it and pass it down to the next generation at the school. Some of them have been there for 20, 30 years now, particularly in Scandinavia, and are still kept in good condition. Some of them could survive to become the monuments for the future. And lots of new designs have come along. Designs like the top left there, like the old medieval design, but made a little simpler so that the path's not so long to walk, made with big wide paths so that people can get round them in wheelchairs.